Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hey, TSS listeners, very quick message from me asking if you could do us a solid and fill out a survey. The link to that survey is in today's show notes, but it's for The Athletic. It gives them a good idea of who's listening, why they're listening, all that good stuff. It's only 20 or so questions. They're all multiple choice. You just click some bubbles and then you hit submit and you are done. You actually hit done instead of submit, if I'm being totally accurate. So please, if you could check out that link, fill out that survey, we would appreciate it. And with that said, on with today's show. The Total Soccer Show. My name is Ryan Bailey. Today, we're previewing the last remaining tranche of Champions League round of 16 first leg matches, and joining me to do so is a man who is as graceful, rare, and beautiful as a Gareth Bale Europa League goal, Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
I'm not sure any of those words apply to me, but I will take it, and I appreciate it, even if you're comparing me to the man bun who can't play soccer anymore. That's fine. That's fine. I'll take
Aww.
It.
Did you see the goal, though? He did this. He sent the defender the wrong way, and when the ball hit the net, it made that pinging noise Ooh. That sometimes it makes when it hits the stanchion. It was a very pleasant noise
All right.
in an empty stadium.
I'll take that. I think I'm just bitter because I was convinced that Gareth Bale was going to be this, like, rediscover his form, be this world beater, start every single game for Tottenham, and here we are. So I think I'm just, like, sort of reverse bitter is all.
Things don't always work out.
Not so much.
You can't always get what you want, as Mick Jagger once said. Now, Tottenham, they beat Wolfsburger, the Austrian Premier League side, 4-1. That's when Gareth Bale scored the aforementioned goal. I'm going to be straight up honest. I'd never heard of Wolfsburger before.
I mean, nor I've heard of Wolfsburg, never Wolfsburger.
Yeah, there's a second Wolfsburg. It's in Austria. Who knew? I did not know that. I sound ignorant, but I'm just going to be honest about it.
I didn't know that either. There we are. I sound equally ignorant. Let's see if Joe does. Joe, Wolfsburger?
Yeah, there we go. Let me introduce Joe, by the way. I haven't even introduced you yet. I do apologize, Joe. How about I introduce you as a man who is as direct, useful, and accurate as a Marcus Rashford Europa League goal? Do you like that one, Joe?
I like that. I think it's better than Taylor's by a significant margin. And I also want to give props to you, Ryan, for saying tranche and stanch already in one show. That's just great work.
I swallowed a dictionary this morning. I apologize for that. Now, Marcus Rashford scored in Man United's 4-0 win over Real Sociedad. I'm pleased to announce I have heard of Real Sociedad, guys.
That's good.
Well done. I'm proud of you.
While we're talking about team names, by the way, I found this thing on Reddit, which had this little explainer of where team names came from.
Right?
So this is really interesting. I'll read out a couple of them. Borussia Dortmund. Borussia may originally stem from the Latin word for Prussia, but the club's founders actually took it from a local brewery. So their club was named after a brewery. I did not know that.
I like that a lot. I like when those sort of like random moments become institutionalized, and I like imagine institutionalized might be the wrong word there, but you know what I mean. That like I like the idea of three dudes just drinking beer and being like, we should name our team after this, and now it's this this like footballing brand of the world over.
They could have been Pabst Blue Ribbon United, but it went a different way, I'm glad to say.
I mean, that would have been the way to go for sure.
Some others here. Juventus, which means youth in Latin, young people. Have you seen their centre backs?
Doesn't quite fit, does it?
Doesn't quite fit. Atalanta's an interesting one. The club was named after Atalante, a heroine in Greek mythology. She's described as a virgin huntress unwilling to marry. I thought it was just from the shampoo bottle that they got the logo, but it actually comes from Greek mythology. Who knew that?
Wait, what is the goddess again? A virgin huntress?
A virgin huntress. She's described as a virgin huntress unwilling to marry.
All right. Okay. All right. That's a lot. I see where you're at. I like it. I like the huntress part, especially feels relevant for the way Atalanta.
I was going to say
it feels
really like tactically apt, doesn't it?
I like it. Yeah.
And the last one on here, RB Leipzig, they got their name from a goddamn soft drink. There we go.
Lawn ball sport, Ryan. Lawn ball sport.
Lashen ball sport. Lawn ball, because we all call it lawn ball, don't we?
Who doesn't? Yeah. Who doesn't call it that? I feel like there is probably some part of England that does call it lawn ball, but that's just my perception of the English calling things funny names.
I say, geez, get my shin pads. It's time for some lawn ball. What, what?
Hey, there it is. It sounded real, Ryan. You made it real. You made it real.
Well, why don't we get straight to the lawn ball action? We're going to talk about the Champions League games coming up. Atletico Madrid against Chelsea is the first one on the docket. Tay-Tay, I want you, sir, to tell me all about Atleti, how they got here, what they're doing at the moment. They're flying pretty high in La Liga, did okay in the Champions League group stage too, huh?
Yeah, we talked about Atleti a little bit on the stereo show last night, Joe and I did, specifically about how we were asked if La Liga would still be entertaining with no Messi and no Ronaldo, and our argument was, or my argument at least, was that it might be more entertaining because we'd have more clubs doing exciting things, potentially challenging. And Atleti were in that conversation, but I kind of framed it as, we know it's Diego Simeone, they're going to be very disciplined, it's two banks of four, they're not the most exciting team. I was wrong. I was definitely wrong, because they have changed things up this season, and we're going to get into how they've changed it up. But first, to answer your initial question, they got here by finishing second in Group A with 9 points. They were behind Bayern Munich, as most clubs are, but they were ahead of RB Salzburg, another RB in there. So they advanced. They are currently top of La Liga, 6 points ahead of Real Madrid, 9 points ahead of Barcelona. But Madrid have played one more game than either Atleti or Barcelona. So we would expect that to tighten up a little bit. But thus far, they are top of La Liga, and they are scoring some goals.
So you got to tell me more about what they're playing like at the moment then, Tay-Tay. I'm guessing this is not the Simeone try and grind out a 1-0 and defend it kind of thing anymore.
I mean, it may still be that in the Champions League. That's what he did last year against Liverpool, is he sort of changed it up and went back to what brung him there is what got him there, and that's what they did. I think this time around they will probably stick with what they've been doing. That's at least my hope, because what they've been doing is playing a 3-1-4-2. They've gone with the three at the back, and then that one is Koke, and he has been the one kind of shielding the back line, but being the one who can help transition when they're in possession. He puts out a lot of fires, and they really are heavily dependent on Koke being good to go. As far as I understand it, he will be, so that will be important. But strangely, a thing I would not have said a year ago, the most important player for Atletico Madrid this season has been Luis Suarez. It is mind-blowing to me. 16 goals in 19 appearances. It was 16 in 17, which was good for an average of a goal every 82 minutes. I read a Sidlo piece about the exit from Barcelona and how that was not particularly pleasant for Luis Suarez, and was basically told, we don't need you, figure it out. And then he did that, and then they tried to block the move last minute because they failed to put into his contract that he couldn't go to a La Liga rival. They tried to do that, but it didn't work, and so here he is, scoring lots of goals and being the sort of leader that you would expect Diego Simeone would have wanted him to be when he brought Luis Suarez in. Same Sid Lopez talks a lot about how you can hear, especially with no crowd noise, Luis Suarez like directing entire sequences of plays of like, you gotta go there, ball there, play it there, I'm moving here. Like it's him moving the pieces, to the extent that I believe he is directly responsible for 12 points gained this season. Ooh. From goals scored or goals assisted, which is more than anyone in Spain, certainly more than anybody playing for Barcelona currently. So Luis Suarez and Koke will remain for Koke, and now are the most important players for Atletico Madrid.
All right, let's move it over to Chelsea then, Joe. Did well in Group E, already got a good result against a Spanish team in the form of Sevilla, and Julen Lopetegui, of course, heading them up, the divorced dad who refuses to pay his alimony. Joe, what do we make of Chelsea at the moment? How did they get to this point?
Chelsea did finish at the top of Group E with 14 points. They didn't have the strongest group, but they did well enough under Frank Lampard at that point. But that's the biggest storyline around this Chelsea team. Frank Lampard is no more. Thomas Tuchel is in. And in the league, they've had a complete turnaround under Thomas Tuchel so far. Chelsea were in ninth place in the English Premier League when Frank Lampard... I don't know why I went English Premier League. That was a bit formal, wasn't it?
It's called the British EPL.
You're right. I'll just say BPL/EPL every single time until you both want to cry. Chelsea were in ninth place when Frank Lampard was sacked. Now they're in fourth. Chelsea haven't lost a single game under Thomas Tuchel. They've only played six games as of time of recording in the league. But they've won five and drawn one. And now they're in fourth place. They are in the Champions League spots for next season. Ooh. If the season ended today. That's that's kind of ridiculous, right? Being able to turn around a team that was really genuinely struggling. Thomas Tuchel comes in, Antonio Rudiger, one of their center backs, called Thomas Tuchel a tactical fox. He's come in and he knows exactly how he wants this team to play. But Tuchel doesn't just know that, he's actually been able to implement it. And I think that might be the most impressive part.
So Rudiger, the guy who was frozen out by the previous manager, is saying nice things about the current manager, you say?
What? You wouldn't believe it, would you?
No.
You wouldn't believe it.
Who'd have thunk it? Well, talking about the previous manager and sort of the struggles he had, Joe, in terms of fitting the pieces in this puzzle, what's Tuchel doing about that situation and sort of what's the style he's implementing?
Thomas Tuchel still has the same challenges that Frank Lampard has in terms of the squad. Like, the squad is still the same. There's still tons of attacking talent there that can't all play at the same time. And it seems to me that Thomas Tuchel is just okay with that. He has no issue ruffling a few feathers. He has no issue playing the players he thinks are the best fits for the spots he wants them in. Right now, that's not really including Christian Pulisic, who is out with another soft tissue injury, if I read that correctly earlier today.
You did.
But playing... I did. Okay, thank you, Taylor. Playing style-wise, Chelsea are now in a 3-4-3 or a 3-4-1-2. It's been mostly that 3-4-3, though, which is a contrast from the 4-3-3 or the 4-3-2... or the 4-2-3-1, excuse me, that Frank Lampard used. So in that three-at-the-back shape, Thomas Tuchel wants the ball. He needs the ball. In his 6 games in charge of Chelsea as of recording in the league, his team has averaged somewhere between 79 and 58% possession in each game. 79% is a ridiculous number. It's so high. Tuchel's team wants the ball all the time. Jorginho has been a key player for him already. He's playing as one of those central midfielders in the double pivot next to Kovacic. Those are both massively important players for Thomas Tuchel. Callum Hudson-Odoi has played right wing back, a very attacking, possession, kind of offensive-minded right wing back. He's been a good fit in that spot. And then it's been Mason Mount and Timo Werner typically underneath Tammy Abraham or Olivier Giroud. Sometimes Mason Mount is playing as that central attacker. It's been a few different looks up top, but Thomas Tuchel wants the ball and he's letting the players who can keep the ball for him play on the field.
It makes sense that Kovacic and Jorginho would be the key men being in the pivot there, particularly if Koke and Suarez are the key men on the other side of the equation, Joe. How about the striker, Abraham and Giroud? Do you see a preference there? Is it going to be the Giroud cameo kind of situation, do you think?
There's a few different options that could happen here, right? I don't know who's going to play against Atletico Madrid. Olivier Giroud certainly has the most experience of the options, and he's been solid, dropping into midfield at times, spraying some nice passes out to the left wing. He's done some good things. Tammy Abraham has done good things as well, although I believe he went off with a slight injury at some point in a recent game. So I don't know what his status is. We could also see Mason Mount play as that kind of highest attacker and then drop down into midfield and have Werner and Hudson-Odoi or Hakim Ziyech run off of him. So there's a bunch of different options, and I'm, to be honest, just glad that I'm not the one who has to make that call.
Yeah, that's why we only get the medium-sized bucks, and he gets the big bucks, I suppose, Joe. Taylor, what do you think about the rhythms of this game, how it's going to shake out? It strikes me as being a pretty evenly matched contest.
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think against the Chelsea of a couple months ago, I think this is probably in Atletico's hands. This time around, I think it's going to be more balanced. I think a big part of that is the situation with Kieran Trippier, which I will do my best to explain. He got a 10-match ban, I believe it was, for breaching betting rules, FA betting rules, for, I guess, allegedly telling a friend to, like, place a wager on him moving to Atleti. That is a...
We've all been there.
Yeah, well, it's a source of, like, much confusion, because then there's the idea of, like, well, who can you tell? Are you allowed to tell your wife? What if your wife tells somebody? It leads to a slippery slope, is the argument there. Either way, that 10-match ban was then enforced, even though it was by the FA. I think FIFA moved to enforce it, meaning that he would have been banned. Then it was appealed. Then it was overruled, but then put back in place. And I think where we stand is that Kieran Trippier will not be playing. We'll see if there's another court ruling between now and then. If he is not, then that probably means it's Simi Vrsaljko will come in and be the more conventional right back. That hasn't been Diego Simeone's favorite thing, and I think Simi Vrsaljko has not been Diego Simeone's favorite thing. He came out at halftime of their recent 1-1 draw with Levante, and it was actually Marcos Llorente, the central midfielder, who became their right wing back. I think that was because they were trying to get that win. They felt like there was an opportunity there. Against Chelsea, I don't think they'll go with an attacking midfielder / central midfielder as their right wing back. I think they probably will go with Vrsaljko, and we will see
even if they are in a back three with Koke ahead of them, I think they'll drop into that 4-4-2 and give Chelsea happily that possession and look to counter through Suarez and through Correa. And I think that they will have some joy, but I think it will be a more definitive Atletico Madrid Champions League tie of defending, frustrating the opposition, and then trying to hit on the counter, trying to create some opportunities themselves, likely through Luis Suarez.
So, Joe, if that right channel for Atleti is a potential point of interest, does that mean Chelsea's left channel, maybe like Alonso or Werner, are going to be having some good action down that channel?
I think that lines up, right? You've got Marcus Alonso, who has reemerged under Thomas Tuchel so far and has played a lot as the left wing back in the 3-4-3 or in the 3-4-1-2. Marcus Alonso is going to have to be up for it if Atletico Madrid are countering down their right side. But right now, the most interesting thing to me about Atletico Madrid is they're not just dangerous in one area with the ball or on the counter. They're dangerous pretty much everywhere. You've got Luis Suarez in the middle. You've got that right side that Taylor's talking about if the pieces align there. And then you've got Yannick Carrasco as that left wing back, who's a very attacking-minded player. Carrasco's almost doing a Belgium, right? He's almost doing what he does for the Belgium national team and playing just as an attacking player, but nominally a left wing back. So there's a lot for Chelsea to keep track of in this game. I'm with you, Taylor. I think the general flow of the match is going to be Tuchel's Chelsea controlling the ball, Simeone's Atletico Madrid playing in that kind of 3-1-4-2 shape and absorbing pressure and then doing some dangerous things with the ball when Atletico Madrid get it. So for Chelsea, I think it's going to be important for them to not pull a Juve against Porto. Can Chelsea break down Atletico Madrid's block? Can they break through the middle and pass the ball into dangerous areas on the ground? Or are they going to have to resort to just playing the ball wide over and over again?
If Carrasco is doing it, if that's what doing a Belgium is, my doing a Belgium is when I like eat a whole box of chocolates while I'm watching Netflix at night.
Mine was going to be making waffles at 3 a.m. So, to each their own.
Mine is going to be watching In Bruges.
Okay, that's fair.
In Bruges, which of course has the line about purgatory being the same as being a Tottenham supporter.
Yeah.
Yes. Great movie. And quite relevant at this time in our lives, I would suggest.
Oh,
as well.
I love that movie so much.
Before we move on from this game, gents, do you want to call which way do we think we want to go? Will we be that bold to give a decision at this point? Taylor?
No. No, I mean, I think I would have bet all the money in the world that Liverpool would get past Atleti last year, and that did not happen. So I have learned to, much like the Germans in a knockout competition, never rule out Atletico Madrid.
Yeah, and I want to echo that. Taylor, I think you've done a good job of pointing out what Atletico Madrid has changed formation-wise and even style-wise. I just want to reiterate, listeners, don't underestimate Atletico Madrid. They're dominating La Liga largely this year. They have one of the best defenses still in all of Europe. They're going to be very difficult for Chelsea to beat. It's not impossible, but it's going to be really, really hard for Chelsea.
It will indeed. All right, gents, we're going to go on to Lazio versus Bayern. We definitely won't be mentioning any relatives of Mussolini or anything like that just after these messages.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Lazio against Bayern Munich. That is the other game that's taking place on Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern, if I am correct. Tete, tell me all about Lazio, what form they're in and how they got to this point. Second in Group F is how I'll start you off.
You are correct. With 10 points, 3 behind winners Borussia Dortmund, but 2 ahead of Club Brugge. More Belgium.
We're doing it. Two wins and four draws, no losses, is a good thing if you're a Lazio fan. A plus four goal difference, the same. Less so that they are currently seventh in Serie A. Yeah. They're, I think, 40 points from 22 games. That said, Roma in third have 43 points. So it's not as though there's a massive gap, but it is maybe still indicative of the way the season has gone for Lazio, whereas this time last season, they're in that conversation for who will win it. They're in that top three. This time around, I think it's not a rebuilding situation. It's more of a squad that's been together for a while, but is not a particularly deep squad. They don't have a ton of massive names across the board and people that can be brought in. You look at Atleti for a moment, and like we didn't even mention Kondogbia, who could sub in, or Saul. They have so many different talented players, to Joe's point. Lazio, it's a bit of they have the starting 11 that they want to go with. They have some questions around their center backs, and that's going to be mostly it. And I'm not trying to do them a disservice. It's just that they are a team that know how they want to play, and they trust their manager to figure it out. And that's about how it's going to go for them, is my understanding of their approach.
They could bring on former Man United legend Andreas Pereira, though, couldn't they?
I mean, that's obviously what we're all hoping for. I'm going to guess Inzaghi is probably not hoping for that himself. What he will be hoping for is that he's got Luis Alberto fully fit and ready to go. He's got Lucas Leiva fully fit and ready to go. Leiva came out at halftime of their most recent game, but I think that may have been more of a precautionary measure. I didn't see much about him dealing with injuries or anything like that. So I think he should be back and ready to go. We'll have Lazio in their sort of 3-5-2. The confusing thing for me is that you do have Lucas Leiva, when Lazio build out, dropping in between the center backs, but it stays a 3-5-2. Usually it's Acerbi will go forward a little bit. It's one of the outside center backs will kind of move their way into midfield. So you keep the 3-5-2 shape. And that's kind of what they do. They build from the back. They have Lucas Leiva drop in. They look to connect quickly. They usually go through the wings and then try to find the feet of Ciro Immobile if they can. But it's a very like tidy Lazio team that do very well in possession and do especially well when they press their opponents. It's what Atalanta found out recently when they were knocked out, or when they lost to Lazio recently. But I think if Lazio are on the front foot and really going for it, they could cause some problems. If Lazio try to sit in and keep their shape, I suspect there could be some problems for them because their back line, their choices at center back are not the best. Wesley Hoth gave up a penalty this past weekend. Harsh because he gets the ball. Probably shouldn't have been a penalty when he takes out, I think it was Lautaro Martinez. But it's also Hoth that goes charging 10 yards up the field and leaves Martinez wide open to then receive a pass and then has to kind of barrel back to make a play. And that's about how it is for their center backs. Every time they make a play, there's then a sort of less defensible one to come. And I think they've got some questions in the offseason about what they want to do with some of the players on loan, if they want to make them permanent, if they want to bring in some new faces. But I think they're going to be setting up in a way to protect that back line. Not to say it's a terrible back line. Again, they're in the conversation for top of the table or near the top of the table, but it definitely needs some covering.
I'm interested in this thing about Leiva dropping back. Mm-hmm. So when Acerbi goes forward, Leiva drops back. Does like Hoth or whoever's in the middle move over?
Yeah, they spread out a little bit. All I can figure from watching it is just that Lucas Leiva is a better passer than any of their center backs, and they would rather him be on the ball and be kind of the engine that's driving the team and making the decisions and picking out the passes. And so I think they just trust him to get the ball and move it forward, either bringing it up himself or passing it into maybe tighter positions than they would trust any other center back to do.
So talking about the engine, can we deduce that Lazio's key men are perhaps those men in the middle? It's Leiva,
yes.
Luis Alberto, Milinkovic-Savic?
Yeah, I would say those three are kind of ever-present fixtures for this team. Luis Alberto dealing with some injuries, but I think we'll be good to go for this one. And he is the other one who can sort of find that pass. If there's a yard gap between two defenders, he can thread that needle really, really well. So him looking in for Correa, for Immobile, the aforementioned, I think that's kind of a sequence of Pepe Reina, still in goal, playing it to Lucas Leiva. Lucas Leiva trying to feed of Luis Alberto or Sergei Milinkovic-Savic, who then plays it in for the attackers. You have runners running off, and that's how you create some opportunities. And if not, then you look for players out wide. The other one to mention there would be Adam Marušić, who will be playing left wing back, but is right-footed, as Atalanta found out when he cut inside and hit a screamer. So their wing backs are also more than capable of scoring some goals themselves.
Joe, it is now incumbent upon you to tell us about Bayern Munich. Never heard of them. They had the last action we saw them in at the time of recording was that snowdraw 3-3 against Bielefeld, which is a bit of a wild game. They'll have some time now to have adjusted from hot weather to cold weather, I'd imagine. So this will be a different setup here. Tell us about Bayern, how they got to this point, how good they are, yada yada.
Club World Cup champions Bayern Munich. I mean, they did beat Tigres in that final in Qatar. They are top of the Bundesliga right now, which is not surprising to anyone, including the three of us. We all expect that. Every year we seem to get the same thing because Bayern Munich are filthy good. Right now they are dealing with a host of injuries. They finished top of Group A. I guess I should mention that briefly. They finished top of Group A in the group stage with 16 points, beating Atletico Madrid once, drawing with them once, beating Salzburg and Lokomotiv Moscow, twice. So all four of those games were wins for Bayern Munich. Right now, they do have a lead at the top of the Bundesliga, but they're missing some big pieces. They're missing Benjamin Pavard, who has COVID. They're missing Thomas Müller, who has COVID as well. He might be back. That's kind of an X factor for Bayern Munich in this game, at least in my mind. Thomas Müller might be back in time for that, first leg next week, but I don't really know. I don't think that's been announced yet to the public. Serge Gnabry picked up a thigh injury at the Club World Cup. Douglas Costa is out with a foot injury as well. So that's four key players, not necessarily four starters, but at least two or three starters and four overall key rotation players for Bayern Munich. But they're so deep outside of losing Pavard at right back, which Taylor, you and I have talked about before, some of the difficulties that they have with Sarr playing as their right back. It might have to be Joshua Kimmich. But even if we set that aside, Bayern Munich are so filthy good. I still think they're one of the favorites to win this entire competition, especially if they can get healthy between now and the quarterfinals or the semifinals. They play a lot of 4-2-3-1, but if Thomas Müller is out, I could see Hansi Flick using another central midfielder and playing more of a 4-3-3 that's still very attacking-minded, very possession-oriented. But in a perfect world for Bayern Munich, it's Joshua Kimmich and maybe Leon Goretzka in midfield with Thomas Müller ahead of them, Robert Lewandowski up top, and then any two fast wingers on the outside. That could be Leroy Sané, that could be Douglas Costa when healthy. I mean, there's Serge Gnabry, there are even more options than those. And then it's an extra dose of fast in the form of left back Alphonso Davies coming up that left wing. Bayern overall might be the fastest team in Europe. They're willing to go direct. They're also willing to hold on to the ball. They're going to be really hard for Lazio to deal with.
And all of the key players you mentioned there, Joe, you didn't pick out Eric Choupo-Moting, the man doing the tour of the world's biggest clubs, PSG, Bayern and Stoke, of course. That's interesting. The one that strikes me here as being a real potential difference maker is Joshua Kimmich, who came on in the draw with Bielefeld and switched with Saar. Do you think that's like a key thing? Because he seems to me to be abundantly important when Bayern tend to play.
No, I think that's a really great point, Ryan. Joshua Kimmich and David Alaba, I want to throw him in there too. They're both these really versatile players, right? They can both play in so many different spots. With Alaba, we've seen him play left back in the past for Bayern Munich. Now that Alphonso Davies is there, he's shifted to play left center back in their back four. Earlier, over the last couple weeks, David Alaba has played as a defensive midfielder because Joshua Kimmich has had to move wide or just to get that rotation in midfield. So depending on where Alaba is playing and where Joshua Kimmich is playing, I think when Kimmich is in midfield and Alaba is at center back, Bayern Munich are at their strongest. But just depending on injuries, depending on health for the rest of the squad, that could be a real factor in deciding where those players move on the field against Lazio.
Taylor, be real with me for a second. Is there a world in which Bayern Munich do not win this game?
This game, yes. The entire fixture, no. I think this game, Lazio can cause Bayern problems, especially with the issues that Joe mentioned. If Lazio, they're not a soft team, which isn't a surprise when we talk about Lazio, but they're a team that can deal with setbacks. They can deal with having to make adjustments. I think they play as a unit. They've played together for so long that they have lots of experience. And with some of the issues with Bayern, there's a decent chance that they can keep this nil-nil, that they can maybe get a goal, that they can hold Bayern to maybe only one goal, maybe no goals. We'll see. But I think overall, Bayern will have enough because they can swarm Lazio. I think they can overwhelm. I think they will probably be successfully resistant to Lazio's press if and when they do go that route. So I think just the depth Bayern do have and the technical ability they have to handle things like a high press if and when that happens, to handle the physicality if and when that happens, I think overall Bayern get out of this one. But this one might be a little bit tighter than people would expect at maybe halftime of the first leg.
Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, is there any personnel that Lazio have signed recently you want to talk about?
None that I would love to talk about. I did see the headline that they had signed the grandson of Mussolini, which has been met with much frustration by the fan base, not just because of who he is, but because they're aware of what that coverage is then going to be. I would argue that if you don't want that coverage, maybe don't sign him. It's unfair to go with, you know, like what your grandparents did shouldn't label you in a certain way. But in Italy, maybe it can.
I mean, all those left-wing Guardian reading Lazio fans in the curva, I'm sure they're very offended by the accusations that are put at them, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that was definitely who was upset and frustrated by these things.
Anyway, moving on, Joe. I'm not sure how much more you want to say about this game, but for me, Joe, Lazio, of all the teams remaining in this competition, are the ones, with all due respect to them, that I feel have the least chance of progressing. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah.
Particularly who they're facing, but in general as well.
I think it is fair, and it feels harsh because I haven't seen an overwhelming amount of Lazio this season. I appreciate, Taylor, your insight there. But I put in my notes, this feels like the most lopsided round of 16 matchup to me. Maybe in hindsight, that's actually Barcelona-PSG. Mm-hmm. But in terms of name recognition, in terms of overall squad talent, this feels like the most lopsided matchup. I think if Lazio is smart, I think they should try to pack it in defensively because going toe-to-toe with Bayern Munich feels like a really bad idea. But if that's their strength, if their strength is getting high up the field and pressing and holding onto the ball a little bit, maybe it's best for them to stick with their identity and try to outgun Bayern Munich. But even just that sentence sounds so absurd to me. I don't really see a way that Lazio win this leg or the tie. But who knows? I've been wrong before, and it will happen again.
I think if they are able to hold on, if they were able to like spring a massive surprise, I think it's because of the precision that they'll bring. Like watching them play at times, they're just a very, like, forgive me, this is lazy, but like they remind me of a like stereotypical Italian team in that it's very technical. Like it's very quick passes into tight spaces that are then passed out of pretty successfully, and they keep the ball moving. I think they all have the kind of like equal level of technical precision. You don't have that one player that has to get the ball, that has to find his way through, that they're building all around. So there is some like diffusion of responsibility in a good way, but I still think, even with that said, we're not like, it's, you guys are correct to say that there's a huge talent gap here, and Lazio definitely have an uphill battle ahead of them.
And watch Lazio win this game 1-0 next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. We're going to move on and talk about Atalanta taking on Real Madrid. That's the Wednesday game, one of the Wednesday games at 3 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday, right after these important messages.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
All right, gentlemen. Atalanta taking on Real Madrid. Taylor,
yeah.
Tell me about Atalanta. A dark horse last year facing a perennial Champions League favorite here. How did they get to this point, and what are they playing like at the moment?
Confusing is my answer across the board. they got here by finishing second in their group behind Liverpool, only by 2 points. But again, the record is confusing because they're crushed at home by Liverpool 5-0. Then they defeat Liverpool at Anfield 2-0. They beat Michelin 4-0 in their opening game of the Champions League group stage. They draw 1-1 with them in their penultimate. So it's you're never quite sure with Atalanta, and that extends to their form in Serie A. They're currently sixth level on points with Lazio and Napoli. Again, sixth sounds worse than it is because they're only, I think, 3 points behind Roma in third. But it has not been the sort of like consistent machine of a season that we've seen from Atalanta in the past. Part of that, I think, is the drama and fallout with Papu Gomez, who has obviously left. And part of that is just that teams have
like sort of adjusted to what they bring. It's a little bit like the Leicester situation where teams struggle maybe mid-season to deal with what an opponent is doing. They have the off-season, maybe there's a little bit of a break. Teams figure them out a little bit and it requires adaptation and evolution. I think Atalanta are doing fine with that, but it's not quite that like surprise team that nobody sees coming and then finds a way to make something happen. I think Real Madrid will be very prepared for a difficult opponent, which is exactly what Atalanta will probably be.
Well, besides Castagna and Papu Gomez, they've generally kept the band together from last year, haven't they? Are you inferring there that they've been a bit figured out? Is that what
I think it's like interesting because to me they still haven't at the same time. That people know that they're going to play a back three. They know there's going to be positional rotation and players moving around to try to create overloads and the left wing back suddenly being a central midfielder and the central midfielder being a right forward and the right forward becoming the left wing back. Like they're not opposed to moving people around, but I think defensively they're very good about getting everybody into the exact shape they need to be. I also think that they're very good about flying under the radar when it comes to the individual personalities within the team. If you do any search for best center backs in Serie A, best central midfielders, best attackers, you really will not get many Atalanta hits. It's a lot of the bigger names from a lot of the bigger clubs or big names with smaller clubs. But Atalanta, like, you don't get a lot of love for, say, Jose Luis Palomino, who I think is an incredibly good center back, both on the ball and off the ball, winning it in the air, leading that line, but then can play with it at his feet, can play those long balls,
Taylor,
can ping him in low. I like Palomino a lot, man. And I think this is an Atalanta team that, like, they're looked at as a... I think my understanding is they're looked at as a system squad, and so teams are maybe hesitant to take a player out of that system for fear that they then, without the system around them, won't function as well anymore. But as a result, they don't end up selling that many people, Ryan, to your point, and then they keep people like Josip Iličić. He took time off at the end of last season for a number of different reasons, but now he's back to scoring goals. If he's not scoring, it's Duvan Zapata. If he's not scoring, it's Luis Muriel popping in to score, but Duvan Zapata has had his scoring boots on this season. I think at one point he was averaging a goal every 61 minutes. I think that's cooled off a little bit since then, but they just have that same Atalanta, like... Again, they've got a diverse group of players who are all very good when they need to be. There don't seem to be a ton of huge egos in this team, even though Remo Freuler and Martin Deron would be forgiven for being a bit egotistical because those two central midfielders are fundamental to what this team is doing. They are ever-present fixtures.
And you mentioned Palomino there. I'm with you on that, but it's his counterpart? His counterpart, Christian Romero, who catches my eye and has caught my eye previously, on loan from Juventus. You know, gets up there for the set pieces. He seems like someone who Juventus should be using, frankly.
I mean, we've talked about that before, right? How odd it is that they've chosen not to go with him. I don't know if Christian Romero has picked up an injury, but he has not been as involved in the team. It has been the kind of the same back three of Rafael Toloi, Palomino, and then Berat Jimsiti. I think I'm pronouncing that one, but probably not right. I would be surprised if they rotate away from that one for this game in the Champions League.
All right. Joe, tell us all about their opponents, Real Madrid. How did they get to this point? Are they gonna win this whole thing? Are they going to get past Atalanta first?
So Real Madrid finished first in Group B with just 10 points. It was a really weird group. They lost to Shakhtar Donetsk twice. They drew with Borussia Mönchengladbach once and beat them once. And then they beat Inter Milan twice. So, I don't know, just a really strange set of results for Real Madrid, which kind of encapsulates their season in some ways. They've had some really good stretches of performances. Right now, they're second in La Liga, 6 points behind Atletico Madrid. They have a game in hand, as Taylor mentioned earlier. They haven't been in the best of form recently, but they have won 4 of their last 5 games. They've got a lot of injuries right now. Sergio Ramos, Marcelo, Dani Carvajal, Eden Hazard, other guys on that squad too that maybe aren't quite as big of names as those players. But they're missing a lot of players, like Bayern Munich is missing a lot of players. I think in this game and in this tie, that's going to put them in an interesting spot. Zinedine Zidane has them in a 4-3-3. And it's a lot of names that we know. It's a lot of names that we know, but now they just lack some of the depth. It's Luka Modric and Toni Kroos in front of Casemiro in midfield. Those are Zidane's first choice central midfielders. It's Karim Benzema up top. It's Vinicius on the left wing. It's Marco Asensio on that right wing. So it's a lot of players that we know. Rafael Varane, Nacho at center back. Lucas Vazquez deputizing at right back while Carvajal is out at times. It's a squad we know. But man, this game's going to be so wonky just because of how Atalanta play with their possession setup, which Taylor, you detailed that fluidity really well. also the defensive side of things. Atalanta under Gasperini love to man mark. They man mark more than almost any other major team in Europe. They man mark more other than Leeds and Matias Almeida's San Jose Earthquakes. They man mark, I think, just in that top tier of teams, which is a weird place to be, and it gets to that weird scoreline differential that we see with Atalanta sometimes. Sometimes they win games 5-0. Sometimes they lose games 3-0 because they get pulled apart. And so I just went through Real Madrid play this 4-3-3. They like to keep the ball. They have a lot of names that we know, and we know what they do. But I almost wonder if all that's going to go away just because of how strange Gasperini's Atalanta team actually is.
It does seem like there's two very disparate styles going on here. I think you're quite right there. And we covered the Real Madrid game against Valencia at the weekend on the Weekend Review. And Graham and I noted how it was a very, very impressive performance, albeit Valencia were pretty poor. But it has been a quite up and down season. And I think one thing that certainly Real Madrid fans say is that Carvajal will be really missed because I think he lasted less than half an hour in this game. He was out for a long time prior to that. And he's, when he hasn't played, the argument has been that they've not been quite the solid unit that they should be normally. So I'd ask you, Joe, whether he's a key man. But for me, the key men is the three in the middle you mentioned, Modric, Casemiro, and Kroos, who just, when they run a game, they run a game, right?
Yeah, and still, right? They're still doing that. I looked up the ages of some of these guys. Luka Modric is in his mid-30s. Toni Kroos is in his early 30s. Casemiro is just in his late 20s. But it feels like this trio has been around forever, right? It feels like they've been with Real Madrid forever. And it's amazing to me how good they still are. Will they have the athleticism as a collective unit to deal with Atalanta and to shift and to move and to cover and to track and all of those things? I really don't know. I don't know if they'll be able to handle Atalanta. But on the ball, if they can get free from their markers at times, if they can find space, if Luka Modric can get the ball and be his press-resistant self, he's in the 95th and 92nd percentile with central midfielders in terms of progressive carries and dribble. So he's great with the ball. He's great at moving forward with the ball in midfield. If those three players are on and they can get free and find space, I think this game and this tie tilts in Madrid's favor. If not, Atalanta, I think, are going to be in a really good spot.
My long-standing theory, Joe, about Real Madrid is that whenever Toni Kroos has a good game, Real Madrid do.
Yeah.
There's a direct correlation there. And when he has a bad game, they have a bad game. And I wonder if he's like the linchpin of this whole thing. If he gets enough space to do Toni Kroos things, then that's the key. Is that fair?
No, I think that's a really great point, Ryan. Toni Kroos is not necessarily the metronome, but he conducts this midfield. He is the passer. He is the guy who's going to be spraying those balls into Karim Benzema, into Vinicius on the left wing, into Asensio on the right wing, into Hazard when he's fit and healthy, even though I don't think that's going to be the case for these games against Atalanta. Toni Kroos is the guy in midfield in possession. If he has time and space, Madrid are hard to stop. If he doesn't, then they're in a tough spot.
So basically what we're saying is Gasperini just needs to man mark Toni Kroos and that should solve the entire equation?
I think that's going to happen, though. I think that's actually going to happen. So it might work out for Atalanta.
I should also note, Ryan, I did some quick checking. I appear to have just pulled like the three games that Christian Romero did not participate in recently when I was looking at their footage, because he has started 68% of games, and including one on Valentine's Day, one on February 6th. So also a decent chance Christian Romero is in there, but I think we still have that idea that like they just rotate through, because looking at where he plays, sometimes it's center back, like center back, sometimes it's right center back, sometimes it's left center back. So I think we may see him in there. I still think it won't really change what Atalanta do, which is cause problems, swarm when they want to, create overloads, and then somehow Ilicic scores despite being not particularly fleet of foot. Give him an angle, he'll find a shot.
Well, yeah.
He's so good.
Romero did play against Cagliari at the weekend, as you mentioned it, Taylor. He can do a robust challenge. So what say we get Gasperini to put one on Toni Kroos in the first 5 minutes? Problem solved.
Yeah, I think let's just have that happen. Let's let Toni Kroos know that things are going to be happening all day for him, and we'll see how he responds to it.
Okay, so this is a difficult question for you then, Taylor, because obviously, as I mentioned it, or we mentioned, there's two different styles going on here. I'd say a pretty unpredictable game, but give it your best shot.
I'll go with Atalanta in the first leg. I think Madrid are still going to have their eye on La Liga. They're still going to be worried about what they do this weekend and figuring things out for their league fixtures, which maybe just means they have slightly less time to prep for this game against Atalanta, who aren't going to really change up what they do. So I think anytime you have a team that might try to adjust their approach so that they can better handle what their opponent is going to be doing versus a team that are kind of going to be set in their ways and doing what they do, I tend to give the advantage to the team that will have that extra consistency coming in. Though, I should note, this was my argument for why Leipzig would handle Liverpool, and here we are. So, grain of salt there, but I lean Atalanta in this one. That might just be heart overhead, though.
Taylor Rockwell betting against Real Madrid in the Champions League, no less. Here we go. Joe, what do you say?
I'm going to use my one pass and not predict this game. You guys wouldn't let me get out of Mbappe versus Erling Haaland yesterday, so I'm bringing it back today. I'm copping out. But I do want to give two X factors here because I just have no idea how this game is going to go. But outside of that Toni Kroos X factor, I've got two more. One of them is Rafael Varane. With how Atalanta defend and how aggressive they are and how much they do man mark through midfield and out wide at times as well, I think there's a good chance that Rafael Varane is left unmarked by Atalanta, and he is so good on the ball. He's so good at driving forward with the ball and making the right decisions in possession. If he can get forward and do some dangerous things in the attacking half, in Atalanta's defensive half, that could cause real problems for the Italians. And then the second X factor I want to hit real quick is Josip Iličić. We talked about him already a little bit, but I don't know if Nacho and Ferland Mendy on the left side of Madrid's defense can deal with him. I don't know if Vinicius can track back and help with that enough. I don't know if Casemiro and Toni Kroos can get over there and help those guys either. So I'm going to be watching for how effective Iličić is in this game as well.
Good stuff, Joe. And by the way, we don't give you a pass on these things. You could just say it's a draw if you like.
Okay, it's a draw. It's a draw. It's an 8-8 draw.
8-8 draw from Joe Larry. Wow. I like the sound of that. Why don't we move on to the final game of our tranche of games once again to slip that one in. Borussia Mönchengladbach taking on Manchester City on Wednesday at the same time as this Real Madrid-Atalanta game. Taylor, tell me about Borussia Mönchengladbach in a bit of mixed form at the moment, aren't
they? Uh-huh. Pretty much every team I'm previewing seems to be in mixed form and could be very good or could be very bad. Yeah, Gladbach especially in a strange situation. Marco Rosa, we've talked about this already on the show this week and maybe last. Marco Rosa has confirmed he will be moving to Borussia Dortmund at the end of the season to take over the managerial position there, while managing a club that are ahead of Borussia Dortmund and having a just fine season. Excuse me, they're just behind Borussia Dortmund at time of recording on goal difference. But there's still a decent chance that Gladbach, still alive in Europe, and could maybe pip Dortmund to that final Champions League place. I think Dortmund would not love that given the amount of players they could lose as a result. But that's not what Marco Rosa is worrying about right now. He's worrying about his own team, who got here by finishing second in their group behind Real Madrid, ahead of Shakhtar and Inter. And again, we go with the kind of inconsistency of form. They start off their group stage by draws with Madrid and Inter. Then they get two wins against Shakhtar, who, lest we forget, finished third in this group. And then they lose their remaining games against Madrid and Inter Milan, but they still manage to go through on goal difference to Gladbach. But that's representative of their season. Sometimes very good and blowing the doors off of Borussia Dortmund. Sometimes struggling to create anything against Wolfsburg, who have a very good defense, don't get me wrong. But seeing the kind of lack of attacking flair that Gladbach had in that recent 0-0 draw was slightly disconcerting heading into this Champions League game, I will say.
Yeah, and just to touch on that Group B, which was Real Madrid, Gladbach, Shakhtar, and Inter Milan. Mm-hmm. Very interesting group in that all the teams lost two games. And it's quite rare, I'd say, for Real Madrid, they top the group with two losses. You don't see that every year.
So, no.
And Gladbach had the same two losses on that. They finished 2 points behind Real Madrid in that group. So they obviously held their own in a very difficult group. Who are the key men for them, Taylor?
Sure. It will depend a little bit on who is fit and ready to go. They were without Marcus Thuram this past weekend. They were out without Dennis Zakaria this weekend, both due to knee injuries, both expected to be back. And Zakaria would be the key one in my mind for this team because he can be part of a midfield two against Wolfsburg. They were in defensively a like kind of empty bucket 4-4-2 that the wide midfielders could step up and it would almost be a 4-2-4 at times, but then they would drop back. I think part of that mild change in shape is because you don't have Zacharia, who can be their pivotal holding midfielder, can also be a center back for them if they want to go that route. That is what they did in their 4-2 win over Borussia Dortmund. They dropped Zacharia in. They went with more of a 3-4-1-2, and it worked, although they did still concede. This past weekend, as I said, it was more of a 4-4-2 with Lars Stindl joining Plea up top. So they could go either way, but I think a lot of it will depend on how fit and ready to go Dennis Zacharia is. He'll likely be partnering Florian Neuhaus, who, if people aren't familiar or haven't seen him, I have yet to see Joe Lowry and Florian Neuhaus in the same location at the same time. And if you throw some glasses on Neuhaus, the similarities increase. So that's one thing to keep an eye on, is where is Joe when this game happens? And is Joe quietly keeping his career as a professional footballer under wraps?
Joe, are you going to be in Germany next week at any point?
As a matter of fact, yeah, I just confirmed that flight earlier today. Taylor, that's some sort of coincidence, isn't it? Yeah, probably.
See, there we go. Now I'm wondering. Joe runs into a phone booth and comes out, and Florian Neuhaus joins the game. But until that happens, what we should talk about is maybe some of the things that Gladbach like to do when they're in possession. They do like to build out of the back using their goalkeeper. So Man City will probably try to pressure them there and see what they can create. I laugh because I know it's an annoying thing Ryan does not love when teams insist on continuing to play out of the back. And maybe Gladbach could be punished for that one in this game, but they do some interesting rotations to facilitate players getting open. For example, if it's Rami Bensebaini starting at left back / left wing back, he will get pretty far forward, and it's sometimes one of those central midfielders, usually Florian Neuhaus, who will then drop in and becomes almost that like a left center back, a third center back there. And there's just like positional changes that I think are designed to open up players in areas that you wouldn't expect them to be getting the ball. So how Man City try to nullify that, I think probably via high pressing up the field. But then we have Gladbach able to play out of that pretty quickly. They're really good with the kind of one- and two-touch wall passes down the line. They will thread that needle. They will risk on occasion, like that pass not coming off and being cut out, to try to get quick 1-2s down the sidelines to create then better attacking opportunities. So I think we'll see some rotation and some positional switching from Gladbach. I think we'll see a lot of tight passing. I don't think we'll see them pressing particularly high up the field. They're certainly capable of doing that. But against Man City, who are obviously a very strong opponent, I think they will probably drop in just a little bit more. Maybe they will go with an aggressive press once the ball crosses midfield. But until then, I would expect them to kind of consistently look to regroup and keep that shape.
Taylor, forgive me if this goes beyond the excellent research you've done, but can you speak about Brian Bolo? Because, you know, not that long ago, he was tipped as like the next big thing, and he seems to be a bit of a bit part player for Gladbach. Am I right in thinking that?
I mean, I think a part of that, like where he has the lack of success with Schalke, comes down to the injury history. He moves to Gladbach, has the kind of strong season, but I think is to some extent still dealing with injuries here and there. And then I think to some extent it's just that Gladbach have so many different options. Marcus Thuram doesn't play on the weekend due to injury, I think, but is such an important attacker to them. But you've got Plea, you've got Lars Stindl, and I think they've just got depth there. Jonas Hoffman can play up top as well. So I think the depth means they don't have to rely on one or two key players. But for a player like Brelembolo, who I think needs reps, he needs consistency and would like consistent starts, I think that probably is where some of the development isn't happening, or why he is not as regularly in that starting 11 as often.
Joe, Manchester City, they topped Group C. They've won quite a lot of games in a row. They're never going to lose again. Have I got it about right?
Everything but that last part. Pep Guardiola mentioned something recently I read about, you know, the loss will come. And it will come for Manchester City, but they have won their last 17 games in all competitions, which is a record for an English first division team. They finished first in Group C in the Champions League group stage, beating Olympiacos twice, beating Marseille twice, and then beating Porto once and drawing with them once. Pep has been tinkering a little bit this year. Earlier in the season, Manchester City played out of a 4-2-3-1, which is a little bit unusual for them. Pep has been noted in kind of not really liking that formation, but that's what they were using for a while. And at a certain point, a couple months ago, Pep said it was after their 1-1 draw with West Brom in December, he just didn't like how his team was playing. They weren't dominating games like he wanted them to be. So Pep and the rest of the coaching staff at Man City hit the refresh button a little bit. He said,
Quote, "We had to come back to our game, move the ball quicker, do more passes, stay in position, run less with the ball, do it together. We don't have a specific player to win games. We have to do it together." And whatever he told his players and what he shifted to tactically, which I can talk about in just a minute, it's totally worked. The team, again, has won 17 games in a row, or not lost 17 games in a row. Nope, strike that. The first one is right. In all competitions. So they are flying right now, and they are dominating in the Premier League, and I expect them to play very well in this game as well.
So tell us a bit more about this shift in style. My understanding is it's a bit less intense. They've sort of adapted more to the difficulties of this season.
They've been pressing less. They've been pressing less this season in general, and so I don't know if that's a direct change, but from that Pep quote I just read, it seems like he has emphasized, you know, saving legs a little bit and saving legs for the attack and for their possession shape. And I've seen two possession shapes from Manchester City recently. One of them is a 3-3-4. So I guess I should back up. They'll start out of a 4-3-3 in most situations, or they'll start out of a 4-at-the-back shape, and that's the shape they'll defend in. But then as soon as they get possession, either in their own half or even in the attacking half, things start rotating. Things start shifting. So shape number one that I've seen them use recently is a 3-3-4 with Joao Cancelo coming from right back into midfield and playing next to Rodri, sometimes next to one of the actual central midfielders as well, Bernardo Silva, Ilkay Gundogan. I mean, different options here for City. The other possession shape is a 2-3-5 or a 3-2-5 with Cancelo and sometimes Zinchenko, sometimes Kyle Walker, also joining that midfield group. And so then it's the fullbacks and it's Rodri in midfield. And they've been working for Pep. He's got his wingers out wide again. He's creating space in the attack. They know how to play out of that 2-3-5 shape. That's what they've been using more recently. And that's what Pep used at Bayern Munich. His teams have used it in the past. And the players know how to execute it, and they're doing it right now. They've created a lot of chances. They have the most XG in the Premier League. And then they're counter-pressing really well right now as well. They've allowed the fewest expected goals in the league as well. And that comes from them just pressing aggressively. Not necessarily always high-pressing, but as soon as they lose the ball in the attacking half, they're swarming like the best Pep teams have done in the past, and they're winning the ball back, and they're creating chances again.
So our friend Graham Ruthven, when we after the Tottenham game last weekend, he wrote a piece in which he labelled Joao Cancelo as the key man. And for the reasons you mentioned, the way he pushes up and joins the midfield. And he played on left against Everton midweek, I believe.
Yep.
So would you agree with that? And him being a key man? I mean, they've got lots of key men, to be fair, haven't they?
They do, and Kevin De Bruyne and Sergio Aguero are now back and fit. De Bruyne got on the field against Everton. Aguero was on the bench against Everton earlier this week. But Joao Cancelo is huge for this team. His ability to step into midfield and not just be an okay, decent central midfielder. You know how we talk about, wow, Ederson could maybe play in midfield somewhere, or Manuel Neuer could play, you know, defense for some Bundesliga team. Those aren't true, by the way. But Joao Cancelo can play as a good right back. He can play as a good left back. And he can play as a legit central midfielder. He's been so important for them in making this system tick. Ilkay Gundogan, again, I want to mention his name as well, is in that same category. He's been on an absolute tear in this calendar year. Since the start of 2021, he scored 9 goals. He's looked rejuvenated after that West Brom game and into 2021. So Gundogan occasionally pushing forward into the attack and joining that front line, or staying deeper and pulling the strings in midfield. And then Cancelo moving from fullback into midfield. Both of those guys are huge for Pep right now.
Joe, I wanted to ask like a fairly silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Like, let's go with FIFA for a moment. If you're setting up a team to handle Pep Guardiola's Man City, like, what do you think works well? Because I find myself confused by this fixture, because I could see Gladbach like trying to sit and block off like zones and just getting destroyed. I could see them doing that and frustrating Man City. I could see them pressing Man City and having success, but I could also see Man City passing through that. I find them, like Manchester City under Pep, to be just such a good team at so many different things. I don't feel like there's one sort of like generic way to cause them problems, because Pep is so good at figuring that stuff out. So I'm wondering if you have ideas on where there are vulnerabilities, or what an opponent like Gladbach, who have good players but not next-level players across the board, might be able to find some success.
So if I'm Marco Rose, I am, first of all, hoping for divine intervention.
Yeah,
that's big. That's number one for me. I'd spend the most time on that, probably. But then it's a tough question.
Because it's a risky strategy.
It is. It's a risky strategy. It might pay off, though. I think if you're Mönchengladbach, the biggest weakness, as I see it, with Manchester City right now is City's ability to defend in their own defensive third. Because if you're Pep Guardiola, you don't want to ever be defending in your defensive third. You want to always be defending in the attacking half after you lose the ball. You defend by having the ball, and then you defend in the 5 seconds after you lose the ball. Pep's teams are not usually the most athletic defensively, are not usually the best 1v1 defenders, not made up of the best 1v1 defenders, not made up the best aerial defenders either. So if you're Mönchengladbach, I think the area that you have circled on your tactics board is the final third. But then it's a question of how you get there, right? If we say City are vulnerable in their own defensive third, in Mönchengladbach's attacking third, do you get there by going all out and playing with the ball, breaking through City's high pressure or their counter pressure, and then possessing in the attacking half? Or do you get there by sitting deeper and countering? And I don't know what the best method is. If you're Mönchengladbach, with the way City are counter-pressing right now, maybe it's best to try to play with the ball and try to get it and possess in City's own half and get into that final third. But if you think there's any doubt that you can't play with the ball and that you're going to get roasted on the counter, I think you have to pack it in and absorb pressure and then try to counterattack yourself. So I just kind of talked through all the options and I didn't actually pick one, which I think is something I am often prone to doing because I don't know the answer. But those are the two approaches. You want to get into the final third, especially against Manchester City. They're weakest there, but how you get there, I just don't know because it seems borderline impossible right now.
If Marco Rose is hoping for divine intervention, maybe that comes in the form of Gundogan not playing. He wasn't in the squad against Everton. Okay. I think he might be an injury doubt for this one. So maybe that's what he's holding on to. Because as you mentioned there, with the amount of goals he's got, I think the stat is he scored more than 14 Premier League teams in 2021.
Crazy.
He's definitely scored more than Embolo, who I believe has only scored 3, going back to your original question, Ryan. So maybe that lack of goal-scoring consistency is a problem for Gladbach. Joe, I appreciate that answer. Like, I still don't fully have my head around what Gladbach will do is, I think, what I'm struggling with. Because
they
could go with the counter, and I think Marcus Thuram could be instrumental going down the left side for Gladbach in sort of like quickly transitioning and catching Man City out, but they also have the technical ability to get numbers forward, to move it around and maybe try to like take some of the pressure off and put City on their heels a little bit. I do think that we shouldn't read anything into what happens this weekend because they're playing Mainz and I think they probably will rest a few people. So I won't be surprised if they don't look particularly strong on the weekend, but then do for Man City because they rested Zakaria, for example, or Thuram again, for example. So I think I would say to listeners, watch and see in the first maybe 10 minutes if you see Gladbach sitting off a little bit more and keeping a sort of roughly rigid 4-4-2, because I think that tells us they're going to try to absorb pressure and hit on the counter. If from kickoff you see Gladbach go charging upfield, then I think we know that maybe they're going to be a little bit more aggressive and we can then kind of see how that goes for them.
I think, Taylor, we're actually maybe looking at this all wrong. Not that I disagree with anything you just said, but I've just kind of realized as you're talking, I don't think it's what Borussia Mönchengladbach will do. I think it's what Manchester City will let them do. I don't think Mönchengladbach can come into this game with a defined approach and just live and die by that approach. I think Manchester City are going to come out, they're going to dominate the ball as they do in the Premier League, and they're going to say, okay, Mönchengladbach, you have to sit deep because we are going to take the ball and run it down your throat over and over and over again. So actually, I think my answer to your initial question that you asked me a few minutes ago is, I think Mönchengladbach will sit deep in their own half, maybe not deep, but at least in their own half and defend in that 4-4-2, 4-2-4 block because not necessarily that's what Marco Rosa wants them to do, but because that's what Manchester City want them to do.
Feels like we're erring on the side of Manchester City having the edge in this fixture, gentlemen. I think it's interesting to think that Man City, if I'm not mistaken, have been the favourites in the Champions League to win the whole thing in the past 3 seasons and obviously haven't done so. Taylor? Is this the time?
I mean, see, this is the confusing thing, is Man City do get tripped up by teams we don't see coming. Last season it was Lyon. I cannot remember if Gladbach have had success against Man City in the past. I know they have met previously. I do not remember how that went down, but, you know, a couple seasons ago with a different manager, I don't know how much that actually matters. I don't know, because this is such a strong Man City at this current point. In the past, we've seen them have that hype, but maybe not be performing at domestic level. At least last season, that would be the case. I think they will be okay in this one. I don't know if they win this one handily. I don't know if they're able to even keep a clean sheet. But I think over the course of 2 legs, I expect Man City to be okay. And I think part of that is because I don't see, to Joe's point, I don't see Man City tinkering too much. That's when we've seen Pep maybe be his own worst enemy and try different things to really throw off the opponent, and he ends up throwing off his own team. I don't know how much of that he'll be doing in this game against Gladbach, so I give the advantage to Man City for sure.
Joe?
I think Man City win this game. I think they win this tie. I think they make a deep run in this tournament.
Bold.
Well, I had to have one bold one after I always try to weasel my way out, you know?
It is very bold of you to pick the team that spent $1 billion on players that they might have success in the Champions League, Joe. I commend your bravery.
Isn't that – I thought we were talking about Man City yesterday with Oil City Money FC or whatever it was. You know, I thought that's just Manchester City.
There, Joe.
You're right. My bad.
Well, gents, that's the remaining Champions League round of 16 first leg games very much covered. Thank you so much for your services on this podcast. And thank you, listener, for joining us on this journey. I'm going to go and do a Belgian, I think. It's been a long week. Taylor, what are you up to now?
I forget what... I'm not going to go watch in Bruges, so I'm not going to do a Belgian. I'm instead going to talk to Joe's usual co-host, Jordan, of MLS Assist fame, about the She Believes Cup and the USA's 1-0 win over Canada last night. It was not as impressive or as emphatic as I thought it would be, but I also might just be slightly negative because I think I expected it to be like 3-0 at the half, and it wasn't. So we're going to find out if it was a good performance, a bad result, all those good things with myself and Jordan. That'll be later on this afternoon.
Good stuff. I like the Canadian national anthem, by the way. It's a fun one. Oh, Canada. Joe, how about you?
Yeah, I'm going to wait till 3 a.m. and then pull a Belgian myself. So I just got to wait.
Okay, I've forgotten what your version of that is, so I'm just going to use my imagination. All right, thank you, gents. It's been a blast. We'll catch you next time. Thank you very much, guys.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.